Good afternoon. I'd like to call to order the Special Committee on the University's Operating Budget. Today is February 12th, day 29 of the session. The time is a few minutes after 3. Present, we have Representative Shelley Hughes, Representative Eric Feige, and myself, Chair Kathy Munoz. We have three documents that we're going to work from today, and you should have them in your packets. We have the overview, the color-coded overview. We'll walk through at the end of the presentation the individual increments for the University of Alaska Anchorage. We also have the 2013 operating budget and the actual final numbers for 2012 versus the budgeted amounts. And we'll walk through that with David Teal from Legislative Finance. And then we also have here today the Chancellor from the University of Alaska Anchorage, Chancellor Tom Case, and Vice Chancellor Bill Spindle, who will walk us through the presentation from the University of Alaska Anchorage. At the first meeting, we had an overview on the University of Alaska Southeast budget. Today we're going to hear from Anchorage, and next week we'll have the University of Alaska Fairbanks before us. But before we get going today, I see a lot of students in the audience, and I'd love for you all individually to stand up and introduce yourselves and tell me where you're studying and what your major is, please. And we'll just, we're so happy that you're here, and we really want to give you an opportunity to say hello. So, Callie, do you want to start? There you go.
Hi, my name is Terry Lindrager. I'm majoring in biology and I go to UAA.
I'm Andrew Lessig. I go to UAA as well. I'm a history major and the nominee to be on the Post-Secondary Education Commission.
Wonderful. I'm Andrew O'Connell, the Vice President of Union Students at UAA and also the current commissioner on ACP, double majoring in marketing business at UAA.
Excellent. Hi, I'm Alejandra.
Thank you all for being here. It's great to see you. I know we've had an opportunity to meet with many of you and really appreciate your advocacy and your presence in the Capitol. Thank you for being here. David Teal, would you like to come up, please, and walk us through the allocation, the budgeted and final numbers for 2012, please?
Only because there's a whole new crop of people to confuse.
Right. And I'd like to recognize Representative Josephson. Thank you for being here. Go ahead. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm David Teal, Director of Legislative Finance. And what's on the screen and hopefully in front of you is some numbers that we talked about last meeting. And it's always easier to have numbers in front of you instead of trying to talk about numbers that are in the air. The discussion there was looking only at actuals because that's all you had, and we were trying to explain that the actuals were actually far less than the amount that was authorized to be spent. So now this...
Excuse me, is everybody following Representative Josephson? You have okay, go. Sorry, go ahead.
So now we have the first column here, which is labeled 12 final. That is the budget as the legislature authorized it. It's what the university could spend, assuming that the cash was actually there. And that was the focus of the discussion last time, because we showed you the actuals, and now we, in that third column, we'll show you the difference between final and actual. on a line item basis, I think we can skip. The issue was what fund codes are over-authorized or underspent, whichever way you want to think of it. And there you'll see that federal receipts had $143 million authorized in the final column, but only $127 spent, leaving $15 million unspent. Well, the authorization could have been $10 billion. The authorized level only lets them spend that much money if they get it. And federal receipts are something that they don't know how much they'll get, when they'll get it. So you want to be want to have more authorization than you expect to spend. Because if you get federal grants unexpectedly and you don't have the authority to spend them, you can't spend the money. So $15 million over authorization is about 10%, which is probably an okay number, considering that some of the grants the university gets can be multi-million dollar grants. So you wouldn't want to say, let's cut that number down to something that's more in line with actuals. The next one, where you a general fund match and general fund, you'll notice they spent exactly what was authorized. Well, of course, when you authorize general fund expenditures, that's real cash. There's no waiting for money. It's money in hand. And so they spend every dollar of it. Then you go down to code 1007, which is interagency receipts. Those are simply dollars that are transferred from one agency to another. So some of that budget authority to accept those internal or external transfers to the university, again, you never know how much you're going to get. So there's a tendency to authorize more than is actually spent. No trouble there either, because interagency receipts don't need to be budgeted. If you didn't have enough, you simply add it administratively. Legislature doesn't have to approve it. And that same thing applies to the CIP receipts, code 1061, and to the UA interagency receipts, code 1174 on the bottom. So the big one, both in terms of the discussion here and in numbers, is the university receipts. They're much like federal receipts. You give them an authorization level that may be higher than they expect to collect because you want them to be able to spend everything they do collect. But they don't. The issue here then is they've got $42 million more authorization than they actually collected in tuition and bookstore receipts and all the other sources of revenue, the dorm income and all that is all lumped together as university receipts. So the question before you is whether you should be reducing that $42 million because it's a fairly large percentage of the budget. And in terms of reason, I think you saw the reason, you experienced the reason. You didn't understand the budget because it's presented in a way that says the university's budget is the top of the screen there, $899 million, $890 million, but it isn't $890 million. It's only $834 million, and that's a big difference. So the idea of reducing university receipts to something more in keeping with actuals is that it's less confusing to the legislature, less confusing to the public, and is a better description of the university's actual budget. It doesn't hurt anything that it's there, but it does confuse people. And secondly, it's in terms of budget reductions, as we prepare the fiscal summary, if you were to cut that number, it would appear to be a lower budget. We know there's no real money savings there, but on paper, it looks like the budget's smaller. And that's because the budget is currently overstated.
Representative Josephson, did you have?
I did not. Thank
you. Oh, you did? Okay. So this was what we struggled with last time, the issue of hollow receipts, where the hollow receipts were spread out over all of the different line items in the budget that we were looking at for UAS. So it made it very difficult to, as David said, get a really clear picture of what the actual need was and what the actual spend was. So anyway, thank you for the overview here. And I also would note that that we're working with the university, with the administration, to get a very, you know, a clear idea of what they're comfortable with in terms of eliminating some of those unnecessary shallow receipts. Yes?
I guess I do have a question, because we talked about a 1.25 ratio with the general fund and then the those DGF. So if we were to lower that to make it more understandable, as you suggested, that doesn't impact the general fund amount. We would have to make that as a separate decision. Is that correct? So that ratio we talked about was more of a goal rather than they're not directly tied?
Through the chair, it won't affect the ratio at all, because the 125 ratio is based on actual expenditures.
Oh, it is. Okay.
So the actuals won't change at all. The ratio won't change at all. It will change the other ratio, which is the amount requested, because let's assume that you take the university's request for GF, which is about $10 million, UGF, and then about $8 million worth of DGF. If you remove $40 million of DGF and approve all the governor's UGF increments, you have an increase of $10 million in UGF and a reduction of $32 million or whatever you get to in DGF. It will make the ratio look completely unintelligible. It's a negative number. And in theory, you're supposed to match the UGF and DGF one-to-one. But you don't want to reduce UGF by $42 million when you reduce the DGF. So you're going to have to just say, the ratio doesn't matter this year. We're going to do what we want to do with DGF and do what we want with UGF as independent decisions.
And then over time, then we get an opportunity to get closer in the ratio over time when we have a more accurate figure for what's actually spent versus this artificial number.
Correct. The ratio probably won't make any sense. The one-to-one ratio won't make much sense in FY14, and that may carry over into FY15, depending on how much you reduce the DGF here. But again, going towards that 125 long-term ratio, no impact at all.
Thank you very much, David.
Thank you.
And for the students out there, I know we were just as confused as some some of you look last week when we first got the overview on this concept of hollow receipts. Anyway, next up we have the Chancellor. Thank you so much for being here, and the Vice Chancellor, Chancellor Tom Case, and Vice Chancellor Bill Spindle from the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Tom Case, Chancellor of the University of Alaska Anchorage. And
I'm Bill Spindle, the Vice Chancellor of Administration for the University of Alaska Anchorage.
I would like to start by thanking each of you for your support over the years and your service in the legislature. I also want to thank, Madam Chair, you for recognizing our students back there, because we're really here for two reasons. One is to meet state needs. But the one that's even more important, in my view, is to provide the opportunity for students to change their lives through a university education. And as we get into more detail on this, as an open access university, we have a big responsibility and a big mission to provide that opportunity for students. I'm so pleased to see our student leaders here and participating. What we would like to do, is talk a little bit about the backdrop of the University of Alaska Anchorage, its role in the larger UA system, how what we're doing fits into the strategic direction initiative, and the budget implications that go with that. First of all, our mission really is to provide educational opportunities to discover and disseminate knowledge. Teaching, research, and engagement, creative expressions are the categories that we use to describe the activity sets. As I mentioned, we are an open access university, which brings some challenges to us, but it also brings opportunities across the range. And Alaska is a mix of peoples, of locations, of ability to go full-time. If we had a complete full-time resident campus, we'd have different programs than we have now, but that would cut out the opportunity for so many people. So for us, as difficult as it is, we believe in the mission we have, which is open access, and do what we can for all students. At UAA, we have about 20,000 students. That is within a several hundred person from year to year. 2,300 students graduated in 2012. UAA offers the range of academic degrees, all the way from certificates in welding, for example, right on up to our new capacity to be a PhD granting institution. And we granted our first two PhDs jointly with UAF last year in clinical community psychology, a key state need. We have five campuses. The campus in Anchorage is the largest, with about 16,000 students, and then we have about 4,000 students spread between Kodiak College, Matsu College, Kenai Peninsula College, Prince William Sound, and then extension sites, which are a very important part of that structure, serving Cordova, Copper River Center, Joint Base Elmendorf, Richardson, Eagle River, and Homer, Ketchmack Bay campus. We are organized like this with our colleges. Because of demographics and being in the population center, we really turn out to be Alaska's largest source of workforce education and training, and take that mission very seriously. Engineering is a key partnered activity, which we have had tremendous support from industry, from our advisory boards, work hand in hand with UAF to move the engineering program ahead. Alaska engineers are our favorite. Not that there aren't good engineers from other states that come in, but it takes a while to learn about engineering in the Arctic. And those that we educate here in Alaska who are Alaskans have a head start to begin with. First of all, they understand the conditions better. They're more likely to stay. It's a real opportunity. Our employers tell us they love Alaska engineers. So we are putting a big focus on moving engineering ahead. Academic excellence is something UA takes great pride in, and we are one of the national leaders in undergraduate research. We do a whole lot of emphasis at the faculty level with students in undergraduate research opportunities, and that's paid off over the years because we have a pretty impressive record of Fulbright scholars, Marshall scholars, and Truman scholars, and those are very difficult, prestigious things to win. And we've done that through a very rigorous honors program and concentrating on undergraduate research. We have about 200 student athletes as well, and I'm very proud of them. Many of them are engineering, coincidentally, which I'm doubly proud of because that's a rigorous discipline to be in. But we have attained the highest ever GPA for our student athletes of a 3.21 GPA for our student athletes, and quite pleased with what they do representing us and learning. I'm very, very impressed and proud of our faculty and staff. They've won a number of nationally significant awards as well, some of which you see here. We have learned that we're not very good at the university level at remedial training. It's very difficult when a student arrives for university work and isn't ready for university work. We try our best, but it works so much better, we've learned over the last few years in particular, when students are enabled to arrive prepared. So that has caused us to put a big emphasis on outreach through the K-12 bridging programs. And probably our flagship example of that is the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, ANSEP, which has a long and successful and very distinguished record of inspiring young people early enough and providing the incentive awards to encourage them to continue, once they get the spirit, to take the courses in the science, engineering, technology, and math area, STEM sciences, that will allow them to be successful when they arrive at university. And we do that through summer bridging programs where we bring them in small groups to get the comfort level and learning how to operate in that kind of different environment and outreach. That's very, very important. So we're expanding that model to other areas. In healthcare, the Della Keats program, ExxonMobil has helped make possible Bernard Harris Summer Science Camp, and then our middle school program, which has been very successful in the Eagle River campus with the Matsu Borough School District, is another model that's working very well. So we're very focused on these outreach to K-12 and the bridging programs. I mentioned our student athletes already and their GPA. We also have an amazing cross-country runner, Mika Chalimo, who is national champion. Not bad at Division II. We have the pleasure to live in the most military-friendly state I have ever lived in, and after 33 years serving active duty, I tell you, I really appreciate that. And when I was on active duty here, I would tell every audience I had the opportunity to how much that meant to our military members here. We are a military-friendly state. We must have a military-friendly university, and we have been taking steps aggressively to make that so. And some of the examples here show that. And it's a significant population right now. We have about 1,850 active duty and veteran students with us now. I anticipate that if the national strategy begins to play out, we could see some larger numbers of returning veterans, many of whom have come from back-to-back deployments, very stressful on them, very stressful on the families. So to have a full-service advising and counseling, job placement, military-friendly environment is something that I'm passionate about, the university's passionate about too. We have been selected at UA, one of 11 universities nationwide, to have a Vet Success on Campus program. We've stood that up. We have a Military and Veteran Student Resource Center. For four consecutive years now, we've been designated by GI Jobs Magazine, which is a national publication focusing on transitioning returning military back into the workforce. Been designated as a military-friendly university. So we're making progress. We're not there yet. We appreciate the funding support, particularly in the advising and counseling area, because that's one of the key dynamics that helps us help our returning veterans. It helps in a lot of other ways, too. We have an extension site on JBEAR as well.
Chancellor, on that point, advising and counseling, today when I met with some of the students, that was an issue that they brought forward to me, that they felt needed to have additional support. Do you feel do you feel that you're adequately staffed? Do you feel that there are opportunities to improve what you're doing in advising?
Madam Chair, we need a lot of support, a lot of help in advising and counseling. We are not there yet. We have put a big focus on it. We're getting there. What makes it challenging is the numbers. And my script here, but We have advising and counseling in two domains, and that's something that I didn't fully understand until I got into this position. One is the academic advising and counseling, but the first step is the administrative-oriented advising and counseling. So when a student first comes to us, we need to help be sure that they and we know what their preparedness level is, you know, whether they're in need of some additional work before they start or in what areas. We need to be sure that they understand what the high-demand jobs are that have good salaries at the out upon graduation, if that's the path they choose. If they choose another area, that's fine, but they need to understand what it is they're going into, and to enable them to make the right decision on a track. And then we need to be able to move them to academic counseling, but we need to know where to send them. So that first screening is very important. It's kind of administrative in nature. And then they'll go, say, to the College of Engineering, and they'll get the academic counseling of, okay, if you want to be an engineer, here's what the program is like, here's your preparedness, here's a path, and get them started early and well on the path that they've chosen. So we've had a big emphasis on graduating on time, that is, taking the number of credits that you can to graduate as quickly as you can with as little obstacle in the way. Now, one thing that's important to note is not every student is able to go full-time. So what constitutes an on-time graduation isn't the same for every student. You know, some have full-time jobs. They just can't take a full load. So they're going to take longer to graduate. We want to provide all the assistance we can to remove those obstacles. Advising and counseling is key to that. We'd like to go to mandatory advising and counseling. And right now we don't have that, and that's part of the budget request. So to answer your question, Madam Chair, we are working advising and counseling hard. We are not there yet, and that's part of our request. Bill?
Yes, Representative Pugh.
This is back up on the military slide. You don't need to turn back, but I'm just curious because I was aware that you had an ROTC program, and do you still, and how many students are in that, and how is that funded?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, we do. We have two ROTC units. I was on active duty when we established the first one at UAA, so I'm very, very pleased that they have progressed. We have an Army ROTC as well. The funding aspect for them, I will provide for you later. I don't have that number exactly with me.
Follow up. Does the state provide funding for that, or are those all federal dollars? That I'm not so, especially if it's federal, I don't really need the number right now. Just wondering if there are state dollars going into that.
I need to get back to you on that.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry, through the chair.
One other thing that was brought up today was the online program that you have recently implemented that allows students to track how many credits they have and what the requirements are remaining for their degree programs. But apparently it's not being offered in some of the more rural campuses. And I'm wondering if there's an effort or a plan to extend that.
There is, and I think you're referring to MapWorks, Making Achievement mm-hmm. Possible. That software suite is very powerful. Our Student Affairs Directorate got the software tool, began to implement how we used it as a pilot program a couple years ago. And the first year was pretty successful, but there were a few rough spots in how it was administered. Taken that experience and rolled it into this past year's effort and are beginning to see the power of the approach, because it pulls in data, as you know, from a number of different sources, Banner and other database-related data sources. And what we found out is occasionally we can anticipate problems before the student even knows they're going to have a problem, because there are a series of factors, financial or otherwise, perhaps performance in one or two courses that are fundamental to the track they're on, that the software helps integrate and identify. So we've been able to make some saves. I'm convinced that would have washed out or not succeeded if we hadn't had that tool. So based on that first year, and it was for the freshman class, we are working to get second year module, because it's a different software version that handles second year things. So that's in our request as well. So that will help a lot with advising and counseling.
Okay. And that does extend then to some of the smaller schools as well?
We want to do that.
Okay. All right. Okay. Go ahead and continue, please.
So the one thing I was going to add, Madam Chair, is on the advising piece. Currently, our advisors that we have that meet students as they first come in the door, we have a ratio of about 1 to 450 students, and our request is for 5 additional advisors to bring that down to 1 in 300. So you can see that's still not great, but that's a lot better than the 1 to 450. And as the Chancellor said, the sooner we can impact students right out of the gate with advising, the better chance that they have of being successful. So that's the intent of our request.
And we have been joined by Representative Reinbold. Thank you for being here. That's fine. Thank you.
We had developed for UAA a strategic plan 2017. We were at the midpoint of having developed that plan, and we've been involved for about 6 months of doing a thorough analysis of that strategic plan and seeing how it integrated with the construct of our strategic direction initiative, which is our primary way ahead right now. And in that, the core themes that we had identified earlier and have been moving towards are listed here, involving our instructional program, our research mission, educational opportunities for student success, our role with the community, and the public square aspect, which is community outreach. And these are the 5 elements of the Strategic Direction Initiative, which President Gamble has spoken to you before, and you'll hear more of. But top of the list is student achievement and attainment. That drives what we do, and we have learned through what Alaskans have told us and what we've experienced that productive partnerships with Alaska schools are key to that. I alluded to that earlier. Also, productive partnerships with our public and private industries. Industry support and us meeting the needs of industry is a key activity. And then using the research and development capacity we have to help contribute to Alaska's economic growth and to enhance communities. And then the final one is accountability to the people of Alaska. So we're developing metrics to do that. In terms of our own strategic guidance, access, persistence, and completion tracks to SDI 1 and 2 that I briefed before. So you'll see that notation as we go through here. But in terms I can understand, access is getting people into the university, persistence is keeping them there, and completion is getting them graduated and on to their next task. So that's the way I break that down. And there are a number of ways that we're working to move that ahead. We have established a new division of student access, advising, and transition to focus on that approach. We talked about the previous success of funding MapWorks, and our next step with MapWorks also would allow us to do mandatory student advising. Because right now, student advising is voluntary, and we put a lot of advertising out. You know, we encourage students to, but it's not absolutely mandatory. You know, we think it should be. We think it would be helpful to the students. It would be helpful for us to do our mission better. Second part of that is a dynamic on-campus community that attracts and retains more residential and commuter students. And we have a mix of residential and commuter situations for our students. At the UAA campus, student life is getting one increment more robust every year. And that's an important part. It's not absolutely essential that you have a residence capacity, but we're finding that there's a threshold where student activity, student life on campus does provide opportunities for engaged student leadership and student activities that is helpful for students. And it also helps the commuter students who experience that, although they don't live on campus. A funding support that you have given earlier for the arena that's going up is a key part of that, because student development, engagement, learning is going to be enhanced when we get that up, and it's going to be a community activity center in many ways. It'll certainly be a key activity center on campus. Transferring credit and credit transfer in our multi-campus MAU has been a hot topic, one that we've been focused on for a couple years now, working very hard. We are making progress. I would tell you we're not entirely there yet, but I am encouraged by the progress. We have started a focus with our general education requirement undergraduate degrees, and I'm very pleased to report that 100% of our UAS and UAF GER courses will transfer into UAA and satisfy the same GER requirement at UAA. So that is one area that we've moved ahead in. We're not done yet with that either. I mean, we still have to keep working on this, but we did transfer 270,000 credits into UAA, and that's 41% more than 4 years ago, 6,000 students, 65% more than credits for students. What that does is make the ability much more possible for people to piece together from sources around our entire UA system a degree. So that transferability of credits is really, really important. We have a wonderful new atmosphere in our faculty. We have an organization called Allied Faculty who work together with a complete statewide attitude about how do we really remove obstacles from students moving ahead. Part of it was accreditation difficulties. We're moving ahead with that. But the other part was just procedural and how things are analyzed. And we have a leave behind here that lists a whole number of ways that specific areas where we are moving ahead and being able to transfer credits. And I'm excited with that prospect. And finally, in this regard for access, persistence, and completion, e-learning and delivery of traditional classroom experiences by using technology, VTC classes and others, are really the wave of the future. Since, you know, I was away from the university for 3 years before I came back, and in those 3 years, the faculty had developed so much in comfort level and effectiveness level with developing distance delivery courses that were really effective and quite clever and well orchestrated. Not everyone is, but the progress is tremendous. The technology that is developing enables that very, very strongly. So we're moving ahead. There's a nationwide sea change coming, we're convinced, in distance delivery. It's very valuable also to have a blended program too. So, you know, we were surprised to find out when our distance delivery numbers started coming up, says, this is interesting, we must be drawing people from around other places. Come to find out, a lot of them were students in the dorms on campus that were signing up for distance delivery courses because it helped their schedule, their scheduling problem, and just opened up more opportunities. So we're working very hard to advance.
And I would just add, Madam Chairman, that at this point we have 42 programs online. Half of those are 100% electronically produced, and then 22 are at least 50% media enhanced. And we're happy, we can give you an update on more detail on that if you'd like as well.
We have been assigned at UAA the statewide lead in health education, and we are very fortunate to be part of the WAMI medical school system. The University of Washington School of Medicine is the lead on that. They are at that institution going through a curriculum upgrade, but it allows us to help facilitate medical education across the state. And we're limited in capacity right now by the practicum or the experience that's part of the requirement of the program for service in hospitals. And so we have 20 physician positions, 20 physician assistants, and 20 nursing slots right now. As we get more capacity, and perhaps with the new curriculum that UW School of Medicine is developing, we'll be able to expand that. Healthcare majors, growth rate has been significant over the years, and we don't see that slowing down.
May I, Chancellor, I'm Andy Josephs, and I represent the State House for the or in the UMed. The medical school program you have, a student can do 3 years at UAA and then 1 year at the University of Washington and get their MD? Is that?
Well, right now we offer on campus or in our system in Alaska year 1, 3, and 4. Year 2 is under the current curriculum, the part that requires presence at UW, University of Washington. That is part of the curriculum revision that may give us a bigger opportunity for students to stay here and get the same part.
So, yes, Representative, did you have a follow-up to that? I'm sorry.
Well, just briefly, and then we offer residency programs now. So theoretically, someone could go from graduating high school, I mean, if they just loved Anchorage, and I like Anchorage. It's my district. It's a great town. They could just stay there, except for the second year, and emerge as licensed physicians.
If the capacity of the hospitals we had could take them all, mm-hmm. and that's the issue right now. That just isn't the hospital capacity.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Hughes.
And I'll just add to that, Representative Josephson, and you could have scored some brownie points had you put my daughter in the photo. She's one of the WAMI students. As far as the year 3 and 4, they're picking clinical rotations, and so they might pick something not offered in Alaska, and that ties into what he is saying. And you have to have the population base for enough of those medical conditions to appear enough for them to get the exposure, so there's some challenges there. I have a question, but I think it's important because I didn't realize we were going to go on to a slide that didn't have the word persistence on it, and you were moving into a different thing, because I have spoken with Talis Kohlberg about this, and we hear about the struggling graduation rates we have in this state and the kids coming out, and we were chatting, and he was saying, you know, yes, some kids are graduating, but when they enter the university system, they're not truly prepared, and so they're needing to take remedial classes. And I really like what you said about really trying to get them on track so they can do 4 years and 4 years whenever that works out with their schedule. But are you doing anything to really focus on those kids? Because those are, my understanding, those are the high-risk kids that might not stick with it. So is there any extra attention as far as, or is that part of what your advising and counseling request is about? But I'm just wondering what you're doing as far as those remedial students.
Well, through the chair, Representative Hughes, it is part. And if I might go back, we don't have a residency program along with that. I kind of misspoke. But we, through MapWorks and through our advising and counseling, and we do have tutoring. We have a library-based tutoring program. We have developmental education, a whole section that's engaged in that. So we do put attention to it. Experience not only in our university, but universities everywhere, is it's very difficult to provide sufficient for those who are deeply unprepared. You know, if there's a particular area you missed that you can brush up on and kind of a prep school sort of thing. I mean, my experience with the Air Force Academy was there was a year of prep school. If you didn't quite have what it took academically, but all the other things were good, you could compete for a year in the prep school, and that's how they solved the problem. We have remedial developmental ed capacity, but that's a very expensive not often as you'd like to see successful approach. So that's why we're trying to reach into helping students earlier.
Thank you. Just as follow-up, and I appreciate the fact that you're doing, and ideally we want to have those kids coming out with a high school diploma fully prepared. And I'll just tack on, there is a residency program. It's just not through the University of Alaska Family Medicine Residency.
Right.
So.
Representative Reinbold.
Thank you very much. In regards to the WAMI program, I'm really glad you guys touched in regards to that. My sister decades ago went through that program, and so it's one of those jewels that you guys have, and I think it's great. And I'm very familiar with the residency program too, and I know some people want to expand that residency program up here. But what my question is you said the issue was hospital capacity, why they didn't have more here. Can you elaborate in regards to what? Because we have so many hospitals, from Fairbanks Memorial to the MATSU to any health services to Alaska Regional to Providence. And I mean, what do you mean hospital capacity?
I probably wasn't using the best terminology, but there are some areas of the program that require service in the hospital, and it's good for the hospitals, but it also is burdensome in some ways, because you know it takes the supervision, and there have to be experiences for the people who are going through the process to get. And that's what I'm told. I can provide more background on that for the record. Bill, you may
have. So I can talk a little bit about this. So a nursing student, they have to, certain clinicals that they have to do in the hospital. There's only so many of them. We reach at every hospital in Alaska, and Alaska only have so much capacity for those clinicals. So the problem, we have ramped up the number of faculty, the number of assistance that you need in order to support nursing students. The biggest problem is there aren't enough clinical opportunities for all of the students to take care of everything they need if we kept raising the number of students. So what happens now is we have a waiting list for in the nursing program, for example, sometimes up to 2 years to get into the program, not because we couldn't keep adding more faculty, but we there's only so many of the clinical opportunities in the state. And we work with the hospitals to try and improve those, and they're very helpful. And of course, they want our graduates, so they're every opportunity they can give us, they do. But there is still, even though there, I don't know how many hospitals are in Alaska, we touch all of them.
Okay, and just as a final follow-up, because I've heard so many things, I know so many students who can't get into that nursing program. It is, you know, between the transfer credits and the nursing school, and I'm like, what in the world is the holdup? Is there anything that can be done to change the dynamics that we can help with that?
We got to keep increasing the clinical. So we work with the hospitals, and they know that that's the limiter. So until they can grow those the opportunities for our students to go and get the hands-on experience. Now, you know, we have simulations that we can do, but you can only do so much of that. So that's really the problem, and it's just a physical barrier that we have gone up against. But our nursing leadership, we're working on that all the time and trying to. In fact, now they have a trimester, so the nursing students go all year long in order to get as many of them they can get through the program as soon as they can, so they can bring more into it. They would love to ramp up the number of students. They know the waiting list. That you get frustrated, you go somewhere else. You don't want to wait for 2 years, but that's one of the challenges.
Representative Feige.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's fair to say that the number of clinicals available are related to the population of the state.
I'm sure that has a lot to do with it.
Because, I mean, a clinical is basically a...
It's a real-life experience.
Some kind of real-life situation, exactly. Disease, rash, symptoms that these folks get exposed to. So we basically need more sick people if we're going to increase the clinicals. But students can still go outside to obtain that clinical experience?
I don't think that we are set up to send them outside. I think we are set up to take care of them in Alaska. So as far as I know, we don't set them up outside that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Now, WAMI is a different We have other health programs, partnerships that we have physical therapy with other another university, I think with Creighton University, for example. So we our health university staff looks for, if we can't do it, we try to find a partner that can do it and that we can give them the space to do at least some of the teaching, and then they can work with that university. So that's part of the way we're able to solve that problem. But again, the clinicals is the biggest problem.
Okay, on this point, Representative Hughes and then Representative Josephson.
And I believe for the physicians, it's very much population-based because they have to be exposed to a certain number of the medical conditions. But for nurses and things, my understanding, and I'm wondering if we can help, as Representative Reinbold mentioned, because they take a financial hit when they bring somebody in because it slows their work down a little bit, their teaching. Are we providing any kind of compensation for those hospitals when they're taking on the students, and is that an area where there's a need? And
that's a great question. I don't have an answer through the chair, Representative Hughes, but we can certainly find out. I mean, we have folks that, you know, like I said, are working on that all the time. We'll get you the additional information to see if that is one of the challenges in that area.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In 46 states, there are medical schools, 44. Is the absence of a medical school in Alaska part of the problem with lacking clinical opportunities? I mean, is it? I don't know much about this other than what I see on TV, frankly. But we don't have a teaching hospital in that respect. Is that part of the problem?
Through the chair, if I may, it is part of the problem, but. Probably the larger problem is the cost of getting the very well-trained physicians that hospitals would need to, in the numbers, to have a teaching hospital. So it would require them to invest quite a lot as well, and difficult to support with the population base. I'll go back to one other requirement that is being addressed now, is experience in a trauma ward with injuries in a very, you know, not just one, but, you know, 8 or 10 simultaneous major trauma injuries is something that right now we have to go outside for. We just don't have hospitals of that nature here for that aspect of the program.
Thank you.
All right, please continue. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't think it is surprising that our forecasts are that healthcare student demand will continue to increase, as will the healthcare sector in terms of the Alaska Real Gross State Product for healthcare and social assistance. The trends to date have been swinging up, and the forecast is for continued growth. There. Now, I know there are always improvements we can make, but I have to say I am very pleased with the statewide footprint for healthcare education. And this graphic demonstrates how our medical education program is spread throughout the state, and technology and standardization have really enabled that, because if you haven't had the opportunity to go through Sarah College of Health and see our simulators and the technology for having an expert in a particular field do a broadcast session throughout this whole state domain. And when I visit other campuses throughout the state and look at, they're very small, but they'll have one or two, you know, sim man. We've got sim man, sim woman, and sim baby that are just amazing technology teaching aids there, and then when you combine the distance delivery to it, it's a very effective network. So we'll continue focusing on that. The health science building has been a big help to moving ahead in that regard. 2008, $46 million authorization that you made allowed this to happen. It is a high-tech, very capable building and is the center for facilitating our distance delivery. Now, engineering has gotten a lot of attention, and I alluded to it earlier, one of the fastest growing programs at UAA, UAF, and our joint advocacy with the University of Alaska Fairbanks for the engineering buildings is very important for us. Career and technical education, we know that's an important foundational responsibility that we have, and so for us to continue providing workforce development training in conjunction with the Department of Labor and with the state employers is a high priority for us. We have put a big focus at UAA in the last 3 years on innovation, entrepreneurship, and we have set about a program of awards for research that leads to commercialization potential. So awards for getting a patent application, for getting a patent approved, for beginning a business, and the Regents approved UAA and UAF in a different a little different model, but the same idea, where research has the potential to be commercializable, is patented or has a patent application, to allow students and faculty to come together to really push that into a company and allow the university to own the company for a short time and negotiate a license individually with that company in a ratio that varies with how much the university helped get that thing started, and then spin it off. And other universities have had tremendous success with that. So CWIF Holdings is what we call our board that does that, and it's another way ahead for us to provide funding that we don't have to come to you to ask for. We think it's a high potential for us. We know, though, that the funding horizon, we believe, will be increasingly limited. So we are focused very much on understanding our costs and containing our costs without reducing the capacity for serving our students. So we have several examples here. Cost of education model, Vice Chancellor Spindle can talk to. It's a very nationally proven model that helps us understand what it's costing us to conduct the different programs that we offer. Our space use study is in progress, and it's a hard-nosed look at how do we use our spaces. Are they used to full capacity the very best we can? Sharing spaces. You know, I can remember in my teaching days, it's great to have a classroom that you kind of own, and you might loan it to other people, but you can set it up like you want not. We're way beyond that now. We schedule classes all over the campus, and faculty have learned to adjust to that well. And then going through a third initiative to prioritize the programs that we have in terms of relevance for the state, relevance for the way ahead and the conditions we have. And I'd ask Vice Chancellor Spindle to add to that.
We have a question before we proceed. Representative Reinbold.
Finally speaking, some really, really, I mean, all this is interesting, but this is really, really important. So I'm really happy to see that you're doing the cost education model, the space use study, and this program prioritization process. When are these studies going to be released? When are you going to know? Because I believe we're supplementing you guys $350 million, if I have my figures right, and then there's a couple hundred million dollars of capital and deferred maintenance and all that. And as you know, production goes down, we're all, you know, feeling the pinch. So I think this is really great. You guys are being proactive, and I'd like to know when we're going to be able to see the results of these.
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, the cost of education model we've been working for about 6 months on, and what we're just getting to the point. Part of the problem is making the data work for each of the colleges and each of the different programs too, so they really understand what does it take to run a biology program versus a engineering program. And then what we're trying to look at is biology teachers teach biology to majors, but they also teach it to many other students, and we're trying to understand the impact of biology, for example, across the university, not just in the biology major section. So that, by the end of this study, which we hope to have done in the next couple of months, we'll have a better idea of how we spend money. Now, directly on direct costs for the educators, for the academic side, then we're looking at the indirect side, the overhead side, which is everything else, all the support side of this. And there are, our consultant can compare us to peers so that we can see if we're in line or not in line in some of these things. Combining that with space use, we've also gone and done a study of every classroom we have, what it's capable of, how effective they've been used, and we're missing it as we're at this session. They are briefing the final study, so we have that available now. So as of today, we'll have a study. What that does is give recommendations on how we can use the space better. The tough part then get the faculty to agree to, I'll share this, like the chancellor said, I'll share this this room with someone else, and we'll make better use of scheduling of rooms and so forth. So we hope to have that added to the cost of education model. The third one is the most wide-ranging, and the one that's going to take us the longest is the program prioritization. What we are doing there is we begin to put the task forces together this semester. Over the next 18 months, we're going to review every single academic and administrative program we have. We're developing criteria for academic programs and criteria for administrative programs. And the goal of that is to completely understand, in accordance with those criteria, where they all fit in relation to what's important to us in terms of our mission and where we're going, the demand, the need, and so forth. And that in the fall is when we're going to do the evaluation of that. And then by hopefully January of next year, we'll have that information in the kind of format that we can use to strategically allocate funds. Even now, we have cut our budget more than $7 million over the last 8 years as we have shifted funds from one program to another. So we are already actively moving funds around to strategically impact what we do at what we think is important at UAA. But as enrollment is flattened, is starting to slightly dip, and as we're trying to avoid putting this on the backs of the students by increasing their tuition, up to this year, last year we're 7% tuition increase. This year will only be 2%, and that's a huge number. So, but we want to do it, and that means we're going to have to better be able to operate our programs on the academic and the administrative side. So we are working toward this. We are also working with President Campbell. I was in the military 25 years myself, so I sometimes call him General Gamble. But President Gamble and his staff, they are looking at do some of these things across the entire system. But we're out there doing it right now, and we're happy to share the results.
Okay, that's great, because I know at Eagle River High School, I know you guys do courses. I mean, we share our school all the time, out there at the high school. So I think it would be good if you guys, did that model for community things as well. So I don't know if you do any type of private rentals, but I know the school district rents out stuff a lot, and they charge us fees. Even for the for everything we do, we have to pay. Even as volunteers, we have to pay. So I think that's a model that you can look at. But I guess what my question is, do we have to formally request this education model, the space use study, and the program prioritization? So if we get put on the subcommittee next year, we can fully understand all the great things.
We're happy to share it in whatever format makes sense for you.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair, the final portion here is something I'm very pleased to report on. We have spent an 18-month effort looking at best practices in alumni relations at universities across the U.S., and we've had a very actively engaged group of alumni working with us on this. The result has been the establishment of a new alumni association with a broader mission. Board of Directors has been appointed for this, and we are really excited about our 40,000 alumni with alumni in every state in the union now and the growing capacity that we'll have to support them and them to support us. There's already talk about alumni chapters for particular regions and programs that want to come together, and we have a way to facilitate that now. So our advancement team and faculty and staff in support of this have come a long way in 18 months to really rejuvenate our alumni structure. And at this point, I would like to turn the microphone over to Vice Chancellor Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to show you, this is UAA's pie chart, just to show you that really most of it is personnel services, it's people. So as we look at FY12 actuals and as we move into FY14, you can see the really, and if you look at the governor's budget, it's almost exclusively in the personnel services arena. The next chart is probably more telling. This is shows you where we get our revenue. And as you can see, we get money from the state, but that's only 43%. I mean, it's a very important 43%, but we also, tuition and then the federal receipts make up the lion's share of this. So that is why it is so important to get the receipt authority. And I just wanted to make that point. I know you went over it earlier, but that's what the receipt authority is all about, to help us cover our ability to get that other revenue.
Are you referring to the Federal Receipt Authority?
Yes. Well, that Federal Receipt Authority and the university receipts, which is where our tuition is primarily.
Right. And the area that we're focusing on, of course, is the university receipt authority,
right,
which is about $45 million over what you're actually using. So
absolutely.
That would be a huge tuition increase to
you
cover.
You know, you're right. Yeah, that's a very good point.
Anyway, let's see. We wanted to focus the committee on the actual requests, the increments.
I'm all set.
Are you ready to go?
As I understand, Madam Chair, you'd like to first talk about the new programs, the program expansion, the new facilities, the estimated operating cost, and what that.
So the first four items on that list pertain to University of Alaska Anchorage. If you could go over those.
Exactly. So, Madam Chair, the first one is the UAA Career Tech operating costs, and just in as an overview for all four of these were all four projects that were buildings that came out of the FY11 general obligation bond that took place then. And as part of that bond, Kenai Peninsula got two projects. One was the Career Technical Center, which greatly improves their process technology ability. And that facility due to open in July of 2013. So once you build the building, you need to have operating costs in order to operate. So that's what that amount is for. The second, 346.2 university. Now this one is university receipts. So this is a classic example of receipt authority. We aren't asking for general fund. This is for the new student housing that'll be at Kenai Peninsula College. Because this is an auxiliary and actually makes money, they charge students to live there, they have the money. They will receive the money to pay for the operating expense, but they need the receipt authority. So that's what that one is. The third one is the UA paramedic and nursing addition that's been added to the Matsu campus. And again, that is the operating amount for that. And then the fourth one at Prince William's Sound Community College, they have completely redone their wellness center. Now, wellness center at Prince William Sound is really about 70% of their main building. If you ever have been there, they basically are old grade school, and what used to be the gym is their wellness center, and it was at an advanced age where it had to be completely gutted and redone, and that's, they have done that now, but to operate it, those are the costs needed to for the operating. So those are the four items, Madam Chair.
And then continuing on the next page.
Under number three.
The Anchorage campus, the workforce development grants.
Yes, Madam Chair. Those come from Mental Health Trust. That's a general fund that we get from the Mental Health Trust. And under that 75, thousand, there's a workforce development grant that's actually a collaboration with UA, UAF, and APU. And there's a second grant, actually, I think that's, no, that's also, yes, ma'am, there also the workforce development grant for the Alaska Native Community Advancement in Psychology, another based, came from mental health funds. And I think that's it for that category. Then under number four, there's an additional mental health trust funds authorized, receipts authorized, and there are several grants there. Workforce development grant on interpersonal violence prevention for beneficiaries, then one for technical assistance in implementation of disability abuse response team, the DART team, in certain communities that they are working with. There's a workforce development grant for trust training cooperatives in Alaska Rural Behavioral Health Training Academy, a workforce development grant, specialized skills and service training on serving cognitively impaired offenders, and then finally a beneficiary projects grant called Partners in Policymaking. Those all come from our Mental Health Trust Partnership. Then finally, the ICER, Alaska Education Policy Research Center. That's a center that was funded one time last year, and we're looking for another one-time $250,000 base, which is, well, for one time, again, it was created in the Institute of Social Economic Research, but it's designed to help Alaska go forward in the education policy arena. So the reason for the two one-time year fundings is to see, do we need to continue to do this after 2 years? It'll all be determined on what they find and how useful it is to keep that going. And I believe that is it, Madam Chair.
But that's not an additional $250,000. It's just a continuation of the money already appropriated.
It's a kidding. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Good point. It's not another $250,000. It authorizes this another year of $250,000. Mm-hmm. But unlike, it's not really a base authorization because it's not going to continue on. It's just for 2 one-year periods at this point. Same $250,000. That's correct.
How is the ISER study intended to be used? Is that going to be shared with districts, school districts, with the legislature? What is the plan?
Well, it's actually a center, and what they are doing is working with the many folks in the state, the school system, other higher ed experts, to work on Alaska education policy. As you know, we have yet to come up with the right combination of moving students from K-12 into higher ed and also to graduate the students at the rate not only in college but in the high school as well. So this is going to be working with all those in the state that are focused on this, and I think at the end of each year, I'm not sure exactly what they're going to produce in terms of report, but they are actually going to be working hard to focus on how to increase student achievement is their number one goal. How to make Alaska put it in the top of the group of student achievers. So that's their goal. And do you have anything to add to that?
No. Excuse me, Madam Chair, Michelle Rizik for the record. This was one of the ones that we had intent language for FY for this year to provide a report to the legislature, and so I'm sure your staff person, Christopher Clark, could provide you a copy of the written report that we provided on the progress of this program.
Okay. And is this just for K-12 education, or is it university as well?
It's for university as well. It's across it's Alaska education in general.
Okay. All right. Are there questions? Representative Reinbold.
Okay, I have a question. First of all, I'm trying to read. What is your total amount statewide that you collect for tuition? And the second question, and that would be like for, let's say, a year ago or so. And then what's your total request to the legislature for all campuses, including new capital, operating, and deferred maintenance, your total request statewide this year?
So if you want to pull out the purple book, I know we've been advised not to go there because it has the hidden receipts buried in it. But starting on page 18, you can look at 2012 actuals, and that spells out by category, by line item, all of the expenditures.
So do we have a total?
So in 2012, for instance, the designated DGF university receipts was $97,691,000. That's mostly tuition.
Okay, so tuition is how much collected?
And so you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the DGF, the designated receipts for the university for 2012 is $691,000.
Now, that has more than tuition in it, but we can get you the breakdown. I don't have the breakdown of exactly how much of that. And again, that what you're talking about there includes tuition. It includes as well
indirect
cost recovery that comes from the grant side of the house. But I can get you that breakdown.
I just want tuition.
Gotcha.
Isolate it out.
We will isolate.
I was trying to find it in some of these charts and things, and that's statewide, and then the total all-encompassing request.
I can get you that breakout.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Okay, and again, the numbers are there. The total request in the governor's budget are in the purple book, but they include the hidden receipts.
Yeah, so it's hard. I've tried. Trust me, I studied this for hours and hours and hours, and I'm just trying to figure out the big picture. That's what I want to do.
And we're happy if you would like to come to university sometime. We can sit down and go through that in more detail. We'd be happy to do it.
Mm-hmm. That'd be great.
Yeah, but we're right in the middle of it, right?
I know. I understand.
We only have a few weeks to go in this process. But during the summer too, I think we should have some outreach visits to the university and take tours of some of the facilities.
We would love
that
to host
about.
That.
I've seen a lot of them. I went to your presentation. I've been, my husband's a graduate of Fairbanks, but anyway, I've been there. Very, very, very interested in this. So,
okay. Are there further questions at this point? No. Okay, we did have some questions that need follow up, and one was on the reimbursable costs to hospitals for the clinical portions. I think it was Representative Hughes that brought that up. Representative Reinbold brought up the issue of the space use study and the cost of education model. If you have any more information, more detailed information, that would be helpful. And then she also asked for the tuition specific to the UAA campus.
Statewide.
So Christopher, Chris, if you could get that for us, that would be great.
In the cover of this book, actually, if you want it for the entire system, if you look in the cover, we actually break out.
Do you want to, Michelle? Would you come forward and identify yourself for the record, and then we can
the
walk through it.
Actually, the microphone almost works perfect for me to stand. Actually,
for the record, Michelle Rizik. If you look at the cover, if you happen to have your candy stripe book, but if not, when you get back to your office, you can look at it. Within the cover, we have under the FY12 actuals for the system, student tuition and fees, it was $124 million for FY12.
So we collected $124 statewide?
Right, for the total system.
And where are you looking?
On the front cover here, if you walk over a couple columns and it says FY12 actuals and then go about midway down under receipt authority, and it says DGF. This actually lists the other categories that are included within designated general fund, student tuition fees, indirect cost recovery, and then other university receipts.
Okay, and do you have it broken down by campus?
I do. Not within that book, but I do have that information right here. Of the total amount for tuition and fees of the $124 million, UAA is approximately $70 million, UAF is $40 million, UAS is $11 million, and then since it's student tuition and fees, there's also $1 million that comes to statewide for network fees for infrastructure things related to IT.
Okay, so again, for the UAA, it was
approximately $70 million. $40 million and $11 million.
Okay, and so then in your 2012 actuals, you had $97.6 million. What else would be included in that?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, where's the $97 million that you had?
It's in the governor's budget.
On page 18, you're saying. So that would be for Anchorage campus only. And so the university receipts for the $97 million, they would also have the auxiliary receipts would be included in that, as well as a little bit of indirect cost recovery, and then university receipts.
Okay. thank you, Chancellor, for the presentation today, and Vice Chancellor. It's very nice to have you in Juneau. Thank you for putting together the information for us today, and for follow-up on the questions that were presented to you today. I would appreciate. And then next week we have a meeting scheduled for the 19th, Tuesday, and we will hear from Chancellor Brian Rogers from Fairbanks. And then we do have our work session tentatively, or has it been set?
It's set for here at noon, February 23rd.
February 23rd at noon, and that's a four-hour session. And if you're not able to be here in person, if you can call in, if you have specific recommendations that you want to bring forward in terms of those recommendations, that would go to the full finance committee. Okay. All right. Well, I think we are adjourned. Again, thank you, students, for being here today. It's been wonderful to see you. Thank you. We're adjourned.